Sob Session, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, Judge Flory. The Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this 15th day of September, 2022. We have five cases scheduled for argument this morning. The first is in the matter of Walter Smith's termination of Section 8 benefits. We have loosened our restriction as the COVID concerns are lessened, so you are free to use the center podium microphone if you want. It does raise and lower if that makes it more comfortable for you. Otherwise, you're welcome to use the microphones on either side of the podium. Would each attorney be sure to state his or her name before each leg of your argument so the record is clear as to who is arguing? We do record these arguments. They're available to the public. There is no other recording permitted. And with that, we're ready for argument on the first case from appellant's counsel.
May it please the court. I am, counsel, I am Laura Jelinek. I am attorney for Walter Smith in this case. I work at Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, and I am representing the relator. This case is about a kitchen fire. We all agree that there was a fire in the kitchen in Mr. Smith's apartment. We all agree that no one was home at the time of the fire. And that the fire was accidental. The question before this court is if the PHA met its burden of proving that there was a violation of the program rules and a violation of the lease agreement, and ultimately if Mr. Smith can lose his housing assistance and, albeit his chance at stable housing, for an accident, an accidental fire. To give you some background, Mr. Smith is a disabled adult. He lived at 1477 St. Paul Avenue for years without incident. And he did so because he had two intensive programs that helped him to live independently. And the first program was the Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services Program, which is abbreviated as ARMS, which is a lot easier to say. So his ARMS worker helped him to live independently, Kathy Rivas Carballo, who testified at the administrative hearing. And Ms. Carballo testified she would come over weekly to help Mr. Smith, including bringing him food and helping him with different things necessary to maintain his independence in the apartment. The other service that he had was a PCA, a personal care attendant, and that person did not testify at the administrative hearing, but we know that that person helped him by preparing meals, and that was something that he needed assistance with, and that was something that he availed himself of. We know that on October 15th, 2019, there was a fire. We know that Mr. Smith was not home. We know that his neighbor called the fire department, and his neighbor called Mr. Smith and said, "Your apartment's on fire."
Excuse me.
Bless you. There was damage to the property. There was damage to Mr. Smith's belongings, and he moved into a hotel paid by the Red Cross. The issue before the court today is whether the administrative agency decision is supported by substantial evidence in light of the entire record, or if it's arbitrary and capricious. I want to start out by saying that the hearing officer's decision is not supported by substantial evidence. The PHA submits one piece of evidence, which is a report from the fire department, and it was written by someone who's not at the hearing. It contains hearsay, and it contains hearsay within hearsay.
But there's nothing wrong with that under the federal regulations, is there, Ms. Jelinek?
Under the federal regulations, the report is absolutely admissible. And we're not arguing that it's inadmissible. And Mr. Smith is arguing that the weight given it was improper by the hearing officer.
So considering the deferential standard of review that we apply in these types of cases, Why isn't that enough to support the decision of the hearing officer?
It's not enough to support the decision of the hearing officer because there was in-person testimony by Mr. Smith, there was in-person testimony by Ms. Rivas Carballo, and there was a report from a rental research company showing that the owner of the property did not consider this a lease violation.
The hearing officer, though, found Mr. Smith's testimony to not be credible, didn't he?
The hearing officer found Mr. Smith's theory about how the fire started not to be credible.
Wasn't that a substantial amount of his testimony, though, at the hearing?
Mr. Smith testified concisely. I was not home. I did not start the fire. I did not cook that day. And then the hearing officer impermissibly shifted the burden to Mr. Smith to show, well, why is the fire department report wrong? Mr. Smith was not represented by counsel. I was not there. We do have the transcript, but it put him in a position where he started to say, this isn't fair. This is a conspiracy, which I think was not trying to put in evidence at this appellate argument, but I think that's what threw him. He had to come up with a theory at this hearing about why this report was not credible, which is not what the standard of proof is in the hearing. The preponderance of the evidence has to be proven by the PHA and not Mr. Smith. He does not have to come up with some theory about why this fire was somehow caused by something, although he had some ideas, but he was like, I didn't do it, and he said so clearly. The hearing officer's decision doesn't address that. If the hearing officer's decision said, I looked at the testimony from Ms. Rivas Carballo, I looked at the testimony from Walter Smith, but it doesn't. It says he didn't show the fire department report was wrong, which is...
So I'm looking at the conclusion of law number three. The conclusion by the hearing officer was that the best and most reliable evidence presented in this case is the St. Paul Fire Department investigation. Concludes the fire on the premises was caused by unattended cooking. Mr. Smith has proposed unlikely, so he made a credibility determination, possible causes of the fire, including electrical problems and corruption by firefighters. The preponderance of the evidence establishes that complainant damaged the premises by allowing a fire to start due to unattended cooking. So I'm not exactly following your argument based on that conclusion. Maybe you can help clarify it for me.
Yeah. So I think in order for this court to evaluate what the hearing officer found and what the hearing officer decided with regards to credibility, that he needed to address the fact that Mr. Smith said unequivocally, I did not start the fire, I was not home. And what Ms. Rivas Carballo said unequivocally, not at issue, I guess is what I want to say, that she was there and he was not cooking.
But she was there earlier in the afternoon and she brought a salad. He didn't cook that. But she also testified that he does have a PCA, but she can't state with authority whether he did or did not cook for himself.
Right, which I think was the part where the hearing officer impermissibly shifted the burden to Mr. Smith to show that he never cooks, which I think is a higher standard than saying, did you start the fire, did you cook that day? They were saying, you have to show that you never cooked, and that's the only way you can keep your assistance.
I'm not sure. Is that what they said, or did they say you haven't shown that you did not cook on that day?
Well, and that's the question. We don't know.
Well, the door was locked to the apartment when the firefighters got there. So I think the argument for me might be more persuasive, and I'm not saying it's unpersuasive, but I think it would be maybe more persuasive if there was some ability to show some sort of unfettered access to the apartment, but there wasn't. It was locked. And, you know, the firefighters had to break in to put the fire out.
Right.
Certainly that would seem to suggest that Mr. Smith was the one who was the primary person who had access to his apartment and locked it when he left that day.
So even if it's a close call, even if, you know, the fire department inspector Jay Blank says this was an unattended cooking fire, and Walter Smith says, I did not cook that day, I did not use the stove, I have a PCA that does this for me, so I don't cook. There's two competing pieces of evidence. And the hearing officer, I would argue, did not lay out clearly why one was adopted and one wasn't. But even if the hearing officer looks at those two, it's the burden of the agency to prove there was a violation of the program or the lease. And if it's a close call, I think this court and the hearing officer needs to say the burden is on the PHA, that they have to prove more than Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith doesn't have to prove that there's some alternative theory. It would help him, and if he had been represented by an attorney, I'm sure that attorney would have argued that. I myself would have argued the PCA probably has a key to his apartment, but I wasn't there. I don't know that. We're stuck here with this, you know, decision by the hearing officer, and we don't quite understand or know why Ms. Rivas Carballo's testimony was discounted, or why the information from the property owner was discounted, which to me is kind of a bigger issue. Mr. Smith presented this rental history report to the hearing officer, and it says, I don't have any lease violations. The property owner says, I didn't violate my lease. This was not a lease violation. And that really doesn't appear anywhere in the hearing officer's decision, or it looks like it wasn't reviewed by the hearing officer, or he didn't consider it. And I think that was important in terms of the PHA has to show Mr. Smith violated the family obligations by causing damage or committed serious or repeated lease violations. That's a high standard, serious or repeated lease violations.
In the disjunctive or, and it seems that $40,000 of damage to the apartment and five or six to his own property would be serious. Black smoke pouring out from under a locked, unattended, unoccupied apartment is serious for other people if a fire were to spread.
So I want to break that up. So I understand the issue about the amount of damages, although I think that the amount of damages is only one part of the measure that the owner has to take into account. There can be very small damages that were willful, and those to me to be serious and repeated violations of a lease. But unintentional, like a baseball through a window or falling down the stairs and a hole in the plaster, you know, you have to look at the context of those. And the lease and the program rules imply some kind of, you have to have some kind of intent. And even with the PHA's own evidence, it says unintentional. It says accidental. So there has to be some kind of intent to damage something. It's not just res ipsa loquitur, like this happened and it must be your fault. It's you have to do something to violate the program rules to be terminated from the program and lose your stable housing. And the position is of Mr. Smith that the PHA didn't meet that burden. I want to talk for a minute about the fire report, because the core part of the fire report talks about accident, unintentional, the form of the fire report. The PHA tries to characterize this as negligent in their brief, but I don't think that there is a basis in the record that it rose to that level. I think the
is there a difference between an accident and negligence? I mean, leaving food cooking on top of a stove and leaving the apartment unoccupied and locking the door certainly would be an accident in the sense that he forgot about it. But how would that not also be negligent conduct?
Negligent conduct assumes some kind of intent. It assumes that you set up the situation to do something wrong.
Well, we have accidents all the time. Every car accident that happens is based on negligence, and there's no one that makes a claim that you intentionally drove your car into somebody else.
Fair enough.
That's where I'm struggling with the difference between an accident and negligence.
Well, I mean, if you look at the statutes that govern housing law 504B, it talks about damages to property, and it sets out, it says, let me just get this right, it says willful, malicious, or irresponsible. And it doesn't say accidental, and it doesn't say unintentional. It says you have to have some kind of intent to do the thing. Otherwise, people would lose their housing, they would lose, and I mean, in eviction court, this happens a lot, right? Did you violate your lease? We figure out if you violated your lease. A tenant presents a defense. He says, I didn't do this. This wasn't my intentional. Someone came on the property and broke something. It wasn't my intent to break something. So I think that is an important factor in the serious or repeated lease violation, the program violation rules, and the burden is on the PHA to show that that happened. We don't want people to lose their housing over accidents. We don't want people to lose their subsidy over accidents. And we absolutely don't want people to lose their subsidy if the housing provider, the person that's owning the building, says, we're good, we understand, it was an accident. And I see my time is up.
All right, you will have 5 minutes to argue on rebuttal if you choose to use it. Right, we'll next hear from counsel for respondent, and I'm just going to step over to Marshall to get my eyeglasses, which I forgot in chambers. Sorry for the interruption. I can see everyone now. Your name for the record?
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Sean Watley, and I'm attorney for respondent, Public Housing Agency of the City of St. Paul. This case does involve the termination of Section 8 benefits following a fire that caused thousands of dollars of damage to an apartment complex unit in the city of St. Paul. The St. Paul Fire Department conducted an investigation and determined it was caused by food left cooking unattended on the stove, and the PHA determined that that conduct was negligent and irresponsible and a violation of program rules. It proceeded to issue a termination, and a full and fair hearing was held before a neutral hearing officer. That hearing complied with federal regulations that govern these proceedings, as well as the Section 8's informal review and hearing procedures. These are requirements promulgated to ensure due process considerations are followed in these administrative hearings. All of those steps were followed, and at the hearing officer considered all evidence presented by all parties involved. That included the documents that the PHA submitted outlining the cause of the fire, the fire report, but it also included almost 100 pages of documents that Relator himself submitted on his own behalf. Those documents were submitted in a packet of papers. They were not organized or referenced, which is part of the source of why some of these documents weren't called out specifically at the hearing. They were not referenced even by Relator directly at the hearing. He would make general reference to a packet of papers rather than to, say, Exhibit 5. And so much of this was reviewed in a large pile of documents as part of preparing the hearing. But in any event, the hearing officer, as the presiding over that hearing, was in the best position to judge the credibility and to make factual findings in this case, and this court should defer to those determinations and fact findings. Now, Realtor challenges the sufficiency of the evidence, saying that there was not substantial evidence. They cite the fire report as being hearsay evidence that shouldn't be relied upon. I think this court properly noted that the federal regulations specifically state that the rules of evidence applicable in normal court proceeding do not apply in these administrative hearings. And there's good reason for that, because these are summary hearings. They are often involve individuals without counsel that themselves would be tripped up if there were formal rules of evidence procedures to have to follow. And it puts the hearing officer in position to consider all conceivable evidence, and then to weigh the reliability, credibility, and trustworthiness of individual pieces of evidence offered in light of their value as hearsay, but they can consider them in light of everything presented. And I think this record is clear. All of the evidence in the record shows there is substantial evidence for the hearing officer to have concluded that realtor committed a violation of both his lease and Section 8 program rules.
I don't know that it's directly in the order, but I mean, I think you can read between the lines and see that Mr. Smith has challenges in life that most of us don't. And was receiving these ARMS and PCA services to assist him in his, you know, everyday living. There was evidence in the record of his clean rental history with this landlord over a number of years. Those seem to be mitigating circumstances. Were they taken into account by the hearing officer in making his determination here?
Yes, Your Honor. The regulations permit consideration of mitigating circumstances. I think it's important to note they do not require it. So, you know, non-consideration or failure to consider it is not itself a basis for overturning a hearing officer's decision. But nonetheless, the record shows, and the PHA, as a matter of course, considers mitigating circumstances in every hearing. And though they were considered, this is a program that caters to an underserved population. Almost everybody, almost by definition, being in this program, has those sorts of challenges in life. And so there is a weighing of the challenges applicable to most of the participants and the implications of program integrity. And I think that's particularly important in this because the Section 8 program is a voluntary program, which means that, especially in St. Paul, landlords are not compelled to participate. They can choose whether or not to accept a Section 8 voucher, and they can choose to reject a tenant for no other reason but that they are in the Section 8 program. And so the entire integrity of this program depends on Section 8 landlords being willing to participate in our program. And one thing that undermines the integrity of our program is if landlords perceive that participants are causing damage, thousands of dollars in damage to a unit, and are allowed to just move on to other apartments without any recourse. That much is clear. That was part of the basis for HUD including regulations allowing termination for property damage and for lease violations, was the desire to create some sort of assurance to landlords that those problems, that the PHA could deal with those problems as they come up. If the program starts having a reputation where its participants, rightly or wrongly, I might add, it doesn't matter if the perception matches reality, but if landlords perceive the population to be more risky than renters as a whole, they would just as soon not decide to take those participants. And that would be detrimental to the entire population of individuals, the thousands of individuals in the city looking for affordable, quality housing. But I want to back up to more to the hearsay argument about the fire report. It's important to note that the fire report was a primary piece of evidence in the hearing, but it was not the only piece of evidence considered by the hearing officer. The record has more than 200 pages of documents that were submitted by both parties, and that's also with the testimony of Relator, his caseworker, and PHA staff. All of that was considered along with the fire report as part of the hearing officer concluding what actually happened by preponderance of the evidence. And essentially what the hearing officer was confronted with were two explanations for what happened. It was the explanation as provided in the fire report, that the fire was caused by negligent, irresponsible conduct. And the alternative theory was that the fire department staged the scene to make it appear as though it was the fault of the Relator, but in fact it was a mechanical issue. And so there was nothing Mr. Smith was not forced to come up with any theory of the argument. He was free to provide whatever explanation he wanted or to provide no explanation at all and hold the PHA to its burden. The PHA presented a case that included the theory in the fire report, and in response to that, Mr. Smith himself stated what he believed he wanted the hearing officer to decide as the alternative theory. And when considering those two options as to what happened, the only two presented, the hearing officer, I think, reasonably concluded that the best evidence available was the fire report and made those findings explicit in the order, saying he did not believe the statements and accusations and scattershot arguments by Realtor were reliable or credible. And that determination, I think, is rightfully left to the hearing officer, and this court should not disturb that on appeal. Realtor also makes arguments about this being an accidental fire, and the regulations, some context around the regulations requiring there to be some intentional aspect to it. I think that's a misreading of the regulations. And further the statutes that were cited. An act can be both an accident and negligent irresponsible conduct. An accident is almost by definition something unintentional, and negligence is itself unintentional. You do not intend something that is done through negligence or irresponsibility, but it is nonetheless a violation that implicates the rules requiring termination. I would say not necessarily all accidents are negligent, but in this case, the accident was negligent. The negligence here was the result of leaving food cooking unattended on a stove. It wasn't like he slipped and fell and fell through a wall, and that was what's at issue here. It was he started cooking, left it unattended, left the unit, left it locked, and that resulted in it cooking over and causing a fire. That is, I think, irresponsible conduct by almost any definition of the term. That's what makes this both an accident and worthy of violation. With respect to how the landlord viewed this situation, they cite to a rental history report as the basis for concluding that the landlord did not perceive this to be a lease violation. As a preliminary issue, the document they're referencing does not stand for that proposition. It was an excerpt from a rental history report. This is a document prepared by a third-party organization based on publicly accessible information as of the date that report is pulled. It is not a one-to-one record of what the landlord thinks or doesn't think about an individual's tenancy. And in this case, that report that they're referencing in the documents was pulled only a few days after the fire, before the dust had even settled on what actually happened. And so the extent it even mirrors information from the landlord, the full facts wouldn't have been known at that time. But what's more telling is in that same packet of information that realtors submitted to the hearing officer, it contains, this is at PHA 173, it contains a move-out statement letter, the document that was sent to him after move-out, reconciling his account, where the landlord had charged $5,000, which was his insurance deductible for the damages caused. This was the landlord charging the tenant for the damage he sustained to his unit. And that would not have been done if the landlord did not believe realtor was not responsible for that damage. And it's not surprising that he didn't issue formal lease termination proceedings or anything of that nature, because the fire caused the unit to be uninhabitable and condemned, and it essentially severed the tenancy relationship immediately at that time. There was no need to seek termination or eviction because he was already out of the unit, and it would just, you can't terminate to seek tenancy back if the unit's already been turned over. So the regulations do not require there to be any formal finding by a landlord or any proceedings initiated for the PHA to conclude there's a lease violation. But in this case, it just wouldn't be practical to see that happening. The record shows, the information that was presented by Relator himself shows that the landlord, in fact, did believe the damage was caused by Relator. That's part of the evidence the PHA had at its disposal as well, showing that not only did the St. Paul Fire Department believe he caused damage, but so did the landlord. And all of that information was presented to the hearing officer, and I believe they were in a position to reasonably conclude that termination was appropriate. And again, this with a deferential standard, I don't think that this court, I think the appeal amounts to realtor seeking to retry the same facts and to get a different determination. What it comes down to is not necessarily an evidentiary issue, but a disagreement with the conclusions that the hearing officer made. And as this court knows, that's not the basis for appeal when essentially not just retrying the same facts. And as opposing counsel noted, he was not represented at the hearing. He was duly noticed about his right to be represented, and all participants are given information about legal resources that are available to them and encouraged at every step in the process to engage an attorney. We can't force anybody to have an attorney, but they are given as much information as possible and encouraged to do so. But nonetheless, whether the arguments Relator made at his hearing were wise, were the arguments he would have made if represented, is neither here nor there. The fact is he made the arguments he did, and the hearing officer was only in a position to consider the information and the arguments that were made to him on the day of the hearing. And I think given what's in the record, what was actually presented, the outcome the decision that was made is based on substantial evidence. It's not arbitrary and capricious. It's relevant and reasonably related to the information presented. And just kind of in closing, there are additional policy. In addition to the policy of ensuring the integrity of the program to encourage as much landlord participation as possible, there's also the fact that the waiting list for the PHA's program is, at this very moment, contains thousands of families. And that's simply because the demand for this sort of assistance greatly outstrips the supply of available vouchers. And so, effectively, in this case, the terminated assistance of Mr. Smith has already been allocated to a different family in need. And so overturning such a decision would essentially be taking away the opportunity of assistance for another family in need. And the PHA needs to be able to prioritize the most deserving, most needy families, individuals who've been on the waiting list for years at this point and who are looking for every opportunity to both have an affordable home and also to comply with all the rules, not to cause damage, not to engage in irresponsible conduct that causes this sort of damage to property. And so part of upholding this decision is furthering that policy to make sure that the assistance is in the hands of those who are most needy and most deserving. And so in conclusion, the record contains substantial evidence that Reeler committed serious violations of Section 8 program rules and his lease by causing the fire through unintended cooking. He received a full and fair hearing that complied with all applicable regulatory and due process requirements, and he may not retry the same fact on appeal hoping for a different result. For those reasons, the PHA would respectfully request that this court defer to those findings and credibility determinations and rule in favor of the PHA. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I wanted to respond to a couple of things in the argument. One, about the program integrity issue that owners won't rent to tenants if there's this perception that they commit damages to property. But this owner did, and this owner would, and this owner said, we will move you to another unit after this fire, but we just don't have one available. And this owner said, you're a fine tenant. We know that this happens. We build this into our business plan. We don't have any beef against you, and we're not going to not rent to Section 8. We would rent to you again if we could, but we don't have another unit. So I think that argument kind of falls apart on the evidence in the record that this owner was not, that was not their intent. And the $40,000 of damages obviously is a little bit inflated based on the actual amount, which was about $5,000. I believe, all the time owners and tenants reconcile those outstanding balances with each other outside of any kind of formal lease termination procedure. The other thing that I wanted to address is that, yes, Mr. Smith has a right to have an attorney. But this court has to ensure these hearings are fair for every unrepresented Mr. Smith that is there and has to prove their case and prove that they shouldn't lose their assistance when the PHA is represented by an attorney and they don't have an attorney. There are 2,800 eligible clients for every legal aid attorney, and I want to ensure and represent Mr. Smith and all of the Mr. Smiths at all of their Section 8 termination hearings. That's not possible. That's not realistic. That's why we have this procedure, the writ of cert procedure, to go to this court and say, this was unfair. Mr. Smith thinks it's unfair. Mr. Smith would like this court to either overturn or remand the case to ensure that even if there isn't an attorney there, that he gets a fair shake, that he gets to not have to prove the alternate theory of why the fire department report is uncredible. He gets to not have to prove that he can have an accident and get terminated for something he didn't intend to do.
Counsel, you made two arguments there. One of them is about, okay, we'll remand and give him perhaps an opportunity to present more evidence on the facts. And the other is a new hearing to determine whether or not you know, negligence counts. It seems like that latter argument goes to legal issues that we could decide. So I want to focus on the argument that we should remand and allow the presentation of further evidence by your client to show that he wasn't responsible for this. What would that evidence be? I mean, what would the hearing officer hear on remand? Is the PCA going to come in and say, I was there, I left the food on the stove? And if, well, I'll leave it at that.
I think the further evidence, if I was representing Mr. Smith in a remand hearing, I would have the housing provider come and testify. And I would want to know.
The landlord?
Yeah.
Okay. And how would the landlord shed light on the issue of who was responsible for the fire?
I think the landlord would say, this was an accident. This is, we build this into our business model. There was issues, there were repair issues in the apartment. We know that.
Does anybody dispute that, though, that this was an accident?
Well, I think the fire report says it's an accident, right? And that's the reliance on the fire report. Although today it was characterized as, you know, intentionally or negligently irresponsible conduct, which I think is a little bit different than accidental conduct in terms of a legal standard.
So the issue is not who started the fire. The issue is how do we classify the fire?
Yeah. And I mean, it would be great to have the fire inspector there. I mean, it would be good to cross-examine that person. He wasn't available at the hearing. He wasn't at the hearing at all to ask him. There were a number of things in the... dialogue and okay. Attached to the fire department report, which, I mean, I think there was a little, I would like to know what is his experience diagnosing or understanding what a disability is versus perhaps alcohol impairment, things like that.
Okay, you answered my question. Why don't you take a minute to wrap up? Or
Thank
a few
you.
Seconds, since we're over.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity. The administrative hearings have to be fair. They have to be free. They have to be free from burden shifting to the tenant who is at an enormous disadvantage, especially if they have a disability and they're not represented by it. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the hearing. The matter is taken under advisement. You'll have our decision in the time required by statute. The next case on the court's calendar is State of Minnesota versus Corey Lyndon Stone. Are the attorneys present and ready for argument?
Yes.
Take a moment to get your things settled.